Buffy St. Marie, if you think about the celebrations of next year and the 150, how do you come into this, and what are you thinking that we should be celebrating?
Stay calm and decolonize. That's all I can say.
Kelly, do you feel like you know more about animation after this conversation than before?
I'm going to throw that question back to you. No, I think if anything, this conversation that we had with both Howie and extended more questions that I have about animation and what it can be and encompass.
It definitely changed the way I thought they were going to answer our questions about animation and the process of it, and then also learning what is a puppet and what isn't a puppet, and how that's animation, but also a 2D animation is also animation, and so on.
Yeah,
so
it's interesting to think that we had this 10-minute, I think, pre-recorded intro conversation about just clarifying how they want their work to be classified within animation. I think that just speaks to the wide range of what animation can be. Just thinking about Anne's work, combining like multiple kind of, what was it? I think we discussed like collage, but then could be also collage animation and then also puppet animation, or is it clay animation?
But it's not claymation. It's not the California Raisins, which apparently might be trademarked. And then we learned what a armature was. Which is, well, you have to listen to the episode to find out what that is. But clearly, we are such novices when it came to animation, but that's why we wanted to talk to these folks, right?
Mm-hmm. I think what's also really neat about this conversation is that both Howie and Anne aren't from Ontario. They're from the prairies, and you had some great, great questions for them both, Aram, that I'm really excited for everyone to hear.
Yeah, it was really a great conversation. It was really expansive, like the prairies themselves. You know, it took it in so many different directions. We talked about topography. We talked about trees. We talked about your conservative neighbors. We talked about Die Hard and James Shigeta. So there's all kinds of stuff that we talked about. And so, you know, it did go a little bit longer than I think we thought, but they were super generous with their time, and I hope a lot of people will enjoy their conversation.
Yeah, the conversation was so extensive, we had to split it into two parts. This episode, you'll hear a live commentary and discussion with Howie on his film Marco's Oriental Noodles. And next week, you'll get to listen to part two, where Anne shares her live commentary on In the Shadow of the Pines, and you'll also get to hear the rest of her conversation about her film then.
And on that note, welcome to Backstory Podcast. I'm Aram Collier.
And I'm Kelly Louie.
Hello, Howie and Anne. Welcome to Backstory Podcast.
Hi, Aram and Kelly.
Thanks for having us.
I think we had a question. Did we want to ask this first off, Aram, about how we should categorize what kind of animation?
Yes. Yes.
Just so we're like properly using, we're using the right voice to address.
So don't call them cartoons. No,
I got in trouble at the end of Viva calling my stuff cartoons. I'm still mad about it.
Really? You got dirty looks?
Yeah, not even dirty looks. They told me flat out, don't call this stuff cartoons. I was like, why?
And Anne, you would verify this attitude?
I don't know who said that to you. Well, no, it's true. We don't usually say cartoons, but I don't know what the reasoning is behind that.
I don't know.
Just the word animation is constantly floating around at the NFB, but I don't think the general public would mind if you called them cartoons.
Yeah, it's true. I think, yeah, I don't know. I also don't like the term graphic novel, so I'm like...
So what do you call those?
Comic books. Anyways.
Okay. So we're down a rabbit hole already. So no, I mean, I think one of the things was to just to clarify. So Howie, not only what you call it, but also what is the technique that you use for your piece?
Sure.
Oh, can you tell us?
So
when we refer to it, it's like,
okay, I get how this is working. Okay. And you probably know better than I do. It's just animation, digital. It's hand drawn, 2D animation.
2D drawing, yeah, 2D drawing.
2D drawing, okay. 2D animation, okay.
Okay.
Drawn animation. There's a lot of different 2D animations. So.
Oh, okay. Drawn 2D animation.
Okay, I'm gonna write this in this general chat.
Okay. Yeah, put that down. Okay.
What are you calling your work, Anne?
I would say stop motion puppet animation.
Okay.
Okay, so it's not claymation.
Right. Yeah. I don't call it claymation, but you can call it claymation if you want.
It is clay, right?
Is claymation copyrighted?
You're right. It might be. Oh. Is it copyrighted by the guys who made
California Raisins?
Yeah, the California Raisins.
And it's a puppet because why?
It's a puppet because it's made with plasticine because I use puppets as my characters. I don't know.
So okay.
That's a very hard question to ask.
I think it's because it's an armature, right? You have an armature? Yeah.
Yeah. I have an armature.
What's an armature?
Basically like a skeleton underneath the clay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if it didn't have that, then it would not be a puppet? It would be a model?
Well, because there's different types of stop motion animation, but you know, when you think of puppets, you just imagine like using dolls, you know, as the characters. But there's sand animation, there's paper cutout stop motion animation. There's clay on glass animation. There's just so many different forms. But as soon as you say puppet animation, you understand that there's little figures that are used as the main characters.
Okay. I'm going to throw out a reference and like it's like Shaun the Sheep or...
Yeah, exactly. Like okay. Wallace and Gromit. Okay. Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas is an example of a puppet stop motion animation.
Okay. Because I feel like they don't ever call those puppets. Or I don't know, maybe they do.
No, I think they call them puppets.
Okay, I'm not paying attention.
what do you hear them, what do they call them?
Yeah, maybe that was just in terms of like when that came out, because that was like, what, late 90s?
Yeah.
So maybe like the memory of like the trademarked claymation was still in people's minds.
Aram actually hasn't seen any movies since 1999.
You could also call it clay animation.
Okay, clay animation. Okay. Well, that clears things up, I guess. Cool. Okay. Question number two, Anne. Because you have you have like photo collages, but that is not animation.
No, it's really just photo collage.
Okay.
And there's also archive footage in my film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I don't call that collage animation. Collage animation.
It could be a new term.
It could.
Breaking new ground.
Sure could. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
There are people that do collage
animation. Yeah.
It's really right. Beautiful.
It is.
There's so many different types of animation too that like it just feels so deep. I mean, it's just like so much more craft involved, like, and planning.
Maybe the way other people do it, not the way I do it.
Well, you know, I actually want to ask you about that because it's interesting, but I'm kicking that down the road. So
okay.
Was all of that part of the podcast or is this like pre-podcast?
So if this is good, well, we may keep some of it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
From Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Howie Shaw is a Toronto-based illustrator, animator, writer, and director. a longtime friend of the festival. Howie's award-winning works have been featured at Real Asian Film Festival, among other places. And he's joined us multiple times on a panel and also as a moderator. A Chalmers Award nominee, his short films have won several awards around the world, including the 2007 Grand Prix at the Tokyo Anime Fair for his work Flutter. He is also a founding partner of the Toronto-based music design film studio, PPF House. Today, he joins us with Marco's Oriental Noodles, which was a part of Jesse Wente's Keep Calm and Decolonize series for CBC.
From Calgary, Alberta, Ann Koizumi is a Montreal-based animator, writer, director, and educator. In 2006, she completed her first professional film, A Prairie Story, with the National Film Board of Canada's Hot House 3, an animation intensive for emerging animators. And in 2011, she completed her master's in film production at York University. Her films have screened nationally and internationally at Annecy International Animation Film Festival, Slamdance, Animation Nation in Singapore, WNDX, and the Calgary International Film Festival. Anne has extensively taught stop-motion animation workshops and is currently working as a media arts educator at the National Film Board of Canada. Today she joins us with In the Shadow of the Pines, a CBC short doc, which was also featured in this year's Hot Docs Festival and given an honorable mention by the jury for Best Canadian Short Doc category. So we are going to talk a little bit about how this episode is going to work. It's a little bit different than what we've done in the first couple of episodes, so let's cover that a little bit first.
Today we're going to ask both of our guests, Howie and Anne, to do a live commentary on their films. So as Aaron mentioned, this is totally different and new, and we're experimenting, and it's cool that we can experiment together. And our producer Sungwoo, the almighty Sungwoo, is going to share his screen. And we'll be streaming both of your works.
Yeah, and Anne and Howie will provide some commentary. So if you're listening to the podcast at home on your device or whatever, stop right now and go watch the videos. We'll put the links in the show notes. So watch those first. We'll wait. Pause it. Watch the movies. And then we'll hear the commentary. And of course, let us know if you like or dislike this format. Give us some feedback and tell us what you think if you'd like to hear more of these.
I thought you were going to say if you like or dislike these films.
No, come on.
It's about the podcast.
It's going to be obvious. Anyway, so we're going to start with Howie and then move on to Anne's work. So, are you guys ready?
Yep.
Yeah.
Sungwoo, count us down to start.
3, 2, 1.
Okay, so this film was a part of Jesse Wendt's series Keep Calm and Decolonize, which was a quote from a speech that Bucky St. Marie made a few years ago. The idea was to imagine a Canada, a decolonized Canada, what that would be. And it was not entirely clear to me. I was quite reticent to actually take on the project because I wasn't sure that I had anything to say or had a right to say anything about the subject. But I eventually came around to it because I kept for some reason thinking about food and specifically noodles and food culture. And I thought there was something that I could talk about from that front, because I feel like food culture, for whatever reason, in all of our sort of political correctness right now, gets a pass in terms of sort of the colonization discussion. Every university kid thinks they are owed authentic ramen or tacos or whatever. There's this very predatory search for authenticity in ethnic foods, and then sort of a gentrification of it as a result. And that seemed like something that I, for whatever reason, could talk about, and that I could kind of relate to my upbringing growing up in Saskatchewan.
And so somehow this film kind of spilled out. I was also interested in thinking about, specifically thinking about the prairies as the future of the prairies. It's science fiction. I've never really done, I like science fiction, kind of. I'm not a hardcore sci-fi guy, but I'd never done anything that was really sci-fi. It seemed like that there was kind of this hole in science fiction as a genre of what small cities or large towns or sort of these not quite urban, like metropolitan and not quite rural sort of cities that make up most of, you know, the world, what those places would look like in the future, what those cultures would look like. And so I wanted to sort of look at specifically what I knew of Saskatchewan and push it into the future and exaggerate and expand on the cultural and fashion and sort of politics of the place. I've run out of time.
Great. That was great. Maybe can you just go to the beginning, like the beginning of the film, past this first card? Yeah. Okay. Right off, what went into deciding this color for this film?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think Saskatchewan, the architecture, the structure of the city is very sort of brown and sort of manly, and in the kind of smaller cities that Longbrook is meant to represent. Longbrook's not a real town or city; it's an imaginary. It's roughly based on like Kindersley and Swiftcurrent and places like that, where a large part of the city is just like the downtown is a single strip, and then you kind of then you're past the city, essentially. So there's that part of it. But then the thing that sort of makes Saskatchewan, I think, special is that the sky inevitably kind of undermines all of that masculinity every day, because it's the sky is really beautiful, and you know, in the dawn and at dusk, it's all sorts of beautiful colors and very sort of soft and rosy colors. So that was part of it, and the other part of it was just there was a very short production time and small budget, and I needed to keep things simple.
Howie, you grew up in Saskatoon, is that right?
That's right.
I'm just thinking about like how different Saskatoon looks from small town Saskatchewan, because this to me like could be Saskatoon, but am I totally wrong?
It could be, yeah. I mean, there's parts of it that are parts of Saskatoon that definitely look like this. And you know, going back nowadays, I'm there several times a year still. It's quite Saskatoon specifically is quite an interesting place because the architecture and the space that it has is all the same, but the storefronts specifically are changing quite a lot and look much more contemporary and sort of deconstructed for better and worse as in all cities. But this is kind of my perception of what it trying to hang on to the old sort of low built square architecture, but playing around with more contemporary design and storefronts and such.
I like what you said about the sky in the West, because I also grew up in the West, in the Western United States a little bit too. And maybe, Anne, if you feel this way as well, like there's something about the sky in the West that's just different than Ontario, Montreal. Like you can actually see the sky, and what you say about colors is just so true.
Oh, for sure. I definitely associate the prairies with open sky. And that's very well visually represented here. Like, I don't even think you would have to have written Longbrook, Saskatchewan. I just by looking at that image, I would have thought it was somewhere in the prairies.
But can I ask, though, I mean, because I think about that a lot, right, about why does the sky seem so different in the West? And is it because, like, there's just fewer trees?
I wonder about that a lot, too. I always thought it was just because the architecture was lower built.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I was talking to an architect last summer there, and he was saying that he was really, things were really changing in Saskatoon. They were, like, very seriously, there'd been a lot of, like, four-story buildings they'd been working on. And like, that was a real, like, achievement for him. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's you know, I grew up there. I'd never thought about it, and I, you know, I go back there a lot, but it never sort of occurred to me until sort of that moment that, oh, everything is, you get so much more sky just because there's nothing blocking it.
I mean, that's also a topography thing too, right? Like, it's easier to build, like, if you have wide flat space, mm-hmm. build horizontally, not vertically, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, just like, you know, moving to Ontario, there's a lot of trees here. So that makes me think about the relationship to the sky too. Where I grew up in New Mexico, it's like, there's not a lot of trees. So like, it's a desert. So you just see the sky a lot more too. I don't know. Right. I think about that a lot.
It's the same in Montreal too. Like, there's tons of trees in my neighborhood, and it's an older neighborhood. So these trees are like massive, you know, whereas in Calgary, where my mom lives, it's just like there's trees, but they're like not nearly as big as the ones here. And you can see, and again, she lives in the suburbs though, because so you can see obviously a lot of the open sky. So yeah, I'm sure the trees do have a lot to do with it.
Welcome to Backstory, a podcast about trees. Okay, so
I feel like I'm just going to be giggling in the background.
You know, it's funny talking about the topography, though, because I several years ago now, I was doing a pilot for Disney based in Saskatchewan, and I had these incredible people working with me, and this incredible layout artist who had done this beautiful, like, I'd given him some sort of direction about what I wanted this, you know, location to look like. And he did this beautiful sort of painting of like rolling hills and stuff. And I was like, I love this, but this looks nothing like Saskatchewan. You just get out your ruler and just draw a straight line.
So like the pilot was like actually taking place in Saskatchewan? Like the story was actually taking place in Saskatchewan?
Yeah,
wow.
It was a superhero story in Saskatchewan.
That's awesome.
I said that they could change it if they wanted to, but they were so tickled by the name that they loved it. So there you have it.
I had a question at around 1 minute in. So Sungwei, maybe you can... So when we're inside of the restaurant, I think this is the line where it's like, and who are these yahoos eating this food? The way that you show faces, the way you chose to show faces, is kind of obscured. What was your thinking behind that?
Oh, you know what? I never really thought too much about that. I guess you're right. Part of that might just be a fear of drawing faces and having to invest a clear character and emotion to that person. Then if you draw a face, there has to be like an emotion that comes with it, and I think I didn't have the energy to possibly think that through entirely. Part of it was just I thought maybe this is where the fashion of the time was heading. There's a thing with in Saskatchewan and on the in the Midwest in general, I think, and you probably have noticed, is where, like, still to this day, guys wear their baseball caps really low down with really, really thick bill.
Yeah, I feel like I understand that image.
Right, and so their face is all very obscured anyways. So I think maybe that was part of it. Certainly for the main character, that was sort of part of what I was going for. But to exaggerate some of the cut and the proportion to sort of push it into the future a little. But yeah, part of it was, I think, a sense of where fashion might be going.
And, mm-hmm. and where you want it to go.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. But I mean, now that I think of it, actually, though, the other thing is I think that the main character does, it's told from his point of view, and he isn't actually very interested in these. He doesn't see them as people. So I don't think he's looking for their faces, if that makes any sense.
Well, he's certainly more well-defined in his face. I mean, even though sure. you don't see his eyes, you see the kind of like lines on his face. There's much more definition there.
Yeah, and I think it's this thing where it's very easy to treat people like an other and an invading force if you don't sort of pay too much attention to them. It, you know, it's a hipster. The cartoon of a hipster is, you know, a beard and short jeans. Or whatever you want to call it, right? If you can just sort of see that whole neighborhood as that, instead of actually looking at their faces and their bodies, then it's easier to sort of criminalize them. So I would say that's from a narrative point of view, that's probably partly what I was thinking at the time.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that, you know, making a sci-fi film would be challenging because you're constantly thinking about, well, what does everything look like in the future? Like, how did you kind of plan that out? Like, from we're talking about just costumes, but everything from, you know, like the restaurant to the way that people eat.
I actually really don't like the design process. So most of this stuff is first pass. I went back and I just moved, so I went back and sort of found all my old scrapbooks and stuff, and I think there's maybe four prep drawings I did before actually just starting the film. I try to board kind of chronologically, so it just sort of happened in a fell swoop. It might be different if I had more time and more budget, but this was a real very fast job, and my wife was about to give birth, so I needed to make sure things were succinct.
Jumping off of on that question, like, I just was curious about the choice of setting this like 20 years ahead, which is the future but also not too far away, where I feel a lot of this film is familiar yet not, and then the noodles that launch you like 4 seconds into the future. So that's really interesting kind of play with time. Yeah, just wondering like the decision making behind that.
It was all very one thing led to another. The film started not in the future, actually. It just started with this idea of food culture and sort of the self-righteousness of food culture, which I'm plenty guilty of. But I felt like, I think one of the things about dealing with telling the story in the future is I felt like I could make judgments and character choices and talk about sort of politics a little bit in a way that was not, wasn't going to sort of offend anyone in the present. They'd give me a bit of distance and a bit of slack in terms of what I could say and not say, and without people saying, you're talking about this and this guy. And so I think that's partly where the future stuff came in. And it helped the psychedelic kind of pseudoscience is the underbelly of it. Was all partly that's like my imagination likes to, I like to think about silly things like that, and partly that it all becomes a tool for sort of not getting a point across, because I'm not sure exactly that there's a clear statement in the film, but it helped to loosen the constraints, I think, of having to say, it made it easier to ask a question than having to say something. I think if I could loosen it up from the confines of the present tense. Does that make any sense, or did I just make noise?
No. I'm curious because it seems like you were trying to be discreet or careful around that you were being that this was part of a commission about decolonization, right? And that
right.
But so maybe you were being careful, but were you also skirting around it a little bit in a way?
I've tended to not make very political work, and but I think, I mean, this was a very, really interesting and freeing kind of a film, I think, or story for me to work on, partly because I think, and maybe you felt this way too, but like, once Trump was elected, this was shortly after Trump was elected, my second reaction after, you know, the first one of like, what, really? Was something around the ballpark of, oh, I'm in a position that most people aren't insofar as I actually know the people that, and I'm friends with and care about some of the people that support the whatever they thought Trump was representing. And it was, as such, I did feel a little bit like it was, I had a responsibility to sort of soften the view of those people and like present them as people and explore them and sort of soften the border between sort of whatever you want to call it, left and right.
And so your protagonist in this would be what you would characterize as one of those people.
Well, yeah, right? I mean, I think the protagonist is the idea, I think, that drew me to him was this, and it's partly of my own getting old, you know, too, is realizing that at some point, people that feel like they're at the cutting edge, inevitably sort of it fall behind the cutting edge and fall behind it and are taken over. And the film itself is actually based, there's in the opening shot, the shop on the very left, called Calvino's, and it's the film is a riff on his book Invisible Cities, which you guys probably know. It's a conversation between Kublai Khan and Marco Polo, where Marco Polo describes one imaginary city after another to Kublai Khan, and the idea, sort of on first reading, you're kind of dazzled by the imagination of these cities, but sort of on revisiting it later in my life, I became much more interested in the Kublai Khan character, because his whole sort of the reason he's asking for this and the problem of this is he's realizing that his empire has grown beyond his not just his control but his understanding, and I felt like that was kind of an inevitable thing that for any of us asking for decolonization, any of us asking for a more open and whatever, the consequences of that will at some point likely be quite foreign to what we anticipated and wanted. So I think that's kind of where the main character for this film sort of comes in, as somebody who started as thinking he was the most cosmopolitan person in the city, and now is fed up with all these people that he doesn't recognize. Thank you. Good night.
But I guess on that, like creating the names for your ramen dishes, how did that come about? And do you have other like ramen dishes that you've come up with, but then they didn't make the cut into the film?
I definitely do. I wish I could remember them, but yes, definitely there were, there was a list of, I think, about 20 that I was all very excited about, but it came down to sort of how many I could fit in and how many I could kind of explain in a reasonable way that didn't require too much sort of exposition. Some of the ones, a lot of them, they, what it ended up having to be was names that you could basically get the idea of them from just hearing the name. Yeah, I just noticed there's a, in the bottom sort of second and a half from the left, it's a tesseract, which I don't remember drawing at all.
Just the last question on this. So, you know, it ends with this great line that says, look how beautiful the future is. How did you feel? Like, what were you trying? What kind of sentiment or closing feeling were you trying to kind of give the audience there?
I can tell you how I kind of arrived at it. I don't know exactly what my intention is, but I for a long time, I was trying to end it from the main character's point of view. I couldn't make it work. It felt too much of a judgment and felt too too closed, what he was saying. I couldn't come up with anything that felt like it kind of, hearing from him at the end, it felt like anything that he said would signify some kind of character arc, either great or small, and I wasn't prepared to commit him to that, and I didn't, and to some extent I don't believe in, you know, that kind of an arc, especially in a 3-minute film. There was a moment where I realized, oh, if I like step away from him and give the sort of the final moment to somebody else that's just observing reality, or her reality, something from someone else's point of view, it felt like that was a better sort of description of where he was failing, is that but without sort of discounting anything he had gone through or was experiencing in any of his thoughts. I felt like shifting the point of view for a moment and showing that there was just this whole other reality that from somebody else's point of view, that it was somehow that I felt like that was the right way to end the film. Yeah. Because I guess, yeah, I won't say too much more.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that punch unthrown.
Backstory Podcast is written and hosted by Aram Collier and Kelly Louie. It's edited and produced by Sungwoo Beck, and is presented by Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. Check out our show notes for more information about Howie and Anne's works. Let us know what you think of this episode. Email us at backstory.ra@gmail.com.